You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 15th to the 21st of January 2015. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, news editor Simon Baker and freelance reporter Joe Sandler-Clark, who's with us for a couple of weeks. First up on today's podcast, international students are pawns in a political game, according to the headline of our lead news story this week. HE leaders want Home Secretary Theresa May to stop using overseas students as a political football as details emerge of more proposed visa restrictions. More on that in a second. The Counter-Terrorism and Security Bill had its second reading in the House of Lords this week. But what impact might it have on campus in terms of academic debate and discussion? Joe's been hearing from some concerned experts. And as universities in Europe introduce tenure-track positions, this week's cover feature asks, what efforts are being made to make career progression easier for fledgling academics? But first, the lead news story this week. It's by Chris Havergal, who's not with us. So Simon, in your role as news editor, perhaps you could bring us up to speed, I should say, on yet another story about Theresa May and international students.
Where would we be without Theresa May in the THE? I wonder sometimes. Over Christmas there was a bit of a row that developed after some proposals leaked out that wasn't actually Theresa May. And I've said this officially, but someone quite close to her was briefing that she was proposing quite a radical change to the visa rules, where students finished their studies in this country, they'd have to go back to their own country before reapplying for any other visa. Mm. This caused a huge sort of uproar, and then it's kind of emerged in the last week or so that the idea has been sort of knocked back, and the suggestion is that that's come from George Osborne. And what's become clear through all of that is that the whole international students subject may have become a bit of a pawn in the sort of positioning, jockeying for position in terms of the Conservative leadership after the election, and who, you know, may succeed Cameron. And I suppose this is all hypothetical anyway, because it depends on the Conservatives not really necessarily winning the election, I would have thought. Because then that would only be the obvious kind of time when there would be a successor. But because Theresa May is playing to the right, the Tory party, there's some suggestion that she's making these quite draconian proposals, not as if there was already worries about the student visa regime at the moment, but more draconian proposals just to kind of sort of play to the right of the party and appease the people that might defect to UKIP in terms of voters.
As you said, it caused uproar. I mean, it caused uproar among university leaders, but you might think that among the more sort of general, certain areas of the population at large, it might actually be quite a popular policy, which is precisely why she's, or people close to her are putting it out.
Well, there have been polls that have been done, and I think, I think it was UK, I can't remember last year, I've done polls with the general public that show that, you know, students aren't their concern, really, you know, because there is evidence to suggest that students, by and large, do go back after they've studied. Of course, some want to come here and then work afterwards, but you know that's been restricted already. Whether that would potentially play to voters or not, it's not clear. But anyway, John, you were
going to say. Well, no, I mean, it's quite interesting, isn't it, in terms of the internal politics of the Tory party, that Theresa May is, I don't know if I'm right, she's sort of almost on her own in amongst the sort of top table of people, you know, on this issue. I don't think there's any indications that David Cameron has a particular downer on international students. Certainly George Osborne is being quite staunch in his defence of universities in these issues, or so we understand. And if you think of the other sort of triumvirate of would-be successor to Cameron, of Osborne, May, the other one I suppose is Boris Johnson, and he's always been very supportive, certainly as London Mayor, of, you know, the role of international students and how important they are to the economy and sort of vitality of cities and so on. So she does seem to be, it's something she's using to, perhaps to kind of distinguish herself from some of the other people vying for that top place.
Is this her way of kind of just showing herself to be different to the other
candidates? Well, and of course she's Home Secretary and she's responsible for, you know, the immigration targets and stuff. So, you know, there's clearly, it's not just about jockeying for position. And, you know, there's no point not acknowledging that there is concern about, you know, net migration and all those things. And just the sheer numbers of students coming to the country, it's one of the only ways that, that you'll significantly impact on those numbers in a big way, is if you do something radical to students. But I think I agree with Simon that all the polling that we've seen suggests that, that kind of Joe Public, this isn't something that they care about at the ballot box in particular. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't necessarily consider students who come and study and then by and large go home to be immigrants.
No. Their concern most of the time is about work, really, isn't it? And it's about people taking the jobs that they think that they could have, and that is a lot of the debate, isn't it, around immigration. So, you know, the actual people studying here is not, I wouldn't have thought, something that would be concerning the public, really, when it comes to the immigration debate. So, what this story kind of expands on as well is that, as well as this big proposal that came from May's office or from the Home Office anyway, there are a sort of steady drip of other measures that are being proposed to kind of clamp down on student migration. They won't be on the face of them to clamp down on student migration, but to make it more difficult for people to abuse the system is what the official line will be. But there is a worry that these constant proposals are kind of just presenting negative headlines, really, for universities.
I think it's notable as well, isn't it, that we've got another vice chancellor who's coming out, you know, publicly really quite hard against this in this week's story. So it's Colin Reardon at Cardiff who's talking about the problems that this is causing universities, and saying, he says that the impression is that the Home Secretary sees international students as a problem. And what explanation could there be for that when the evidence doesn't bear it out? I think it's the internal politics of the Conservative Party. It's quite rare, actually, that vice chancellors are willing to come out and speak so openly and be so openly critical of government ministers. And we've certainly had Edward Acton in the past talking about, you know, describing Theresa May as a Dalek and so on. It's one of the few areas that VCs are willing to come out quite hard on, actually.
Mm-mm. A Home Office spokeswoman said, we should add that we continue to work with the education sector to ensure that the abuse of the student visa route is tackled effectively, while at the same time the reputation of our world-class universities is protected. So that's all right then. Page 6 and 7 for that story in its entirety. Joe, let's move things along to the other story on those pages. Given the events in Paris over the last week, discussions about freedom of speech have been very much in the limelight. You've been hearing some concerns about the counter-terrorism and security bill and what that bill might mean for universities.
Well, you had, in the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, you had political leaders proclaiming the importance of freedom of speech and how important it was to defend it and how it's something to be celebrated. And then, of course, you had people pointing out the irony of some of the people's records in terms of defending freedom of speech. And on Monday, David Cameron came out and call for new surveillance powers on top of proposals already contained in the counter-terror bill. Mm-hmm. And this kind of led to a number of people speaking out, including Smita Jamdar, who's head of education at SGH Martineau Solicitors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she was basically making the point that it's sort of inconsistent for Cameron and other government officials to come out and say that on the one hand they value freedom of speech so much, but they're on the other kind of curtailing it in some way through their actions in the counter-terror bill, particularly on restricting the rights of speakers at on campus.
I mean, the bill would give the Home Secretary, again, our favourite person in this podcast, the ultimate power to sort of ban extremist speakers from campuses. It's a thorny issue, isn't it, really, in terms of universities' role on the one hand, defending freedom of speech, but also, you know, we've seen what can happen if sort of governments and the security services don't take very seriously national security. And what do you make of this, John?
Yeah, I mean, it's we had a good piece last week from Martin Hall, former Vice Chancellor of Salford, who was very, very strong in his rejection of the whole kind of philosophy behind this bill, you know, saying that actually you're almost doing the opposite by banning these, you know, discussion of these things on university campuses. You're more likely to drive it underground and to stop sort of ideologies being tackled when they start to emerge. And I think there's something in that. Well, we should note that MPs on the Joint Committee on Human Rights did did sort of outline some of these concerns as well in the last week when they warned that the bill could seriously inhibit academic debate. I don't think this is something that's going to go through quietly and not, you know, these concerns aren't going to be raised and pointed out. But yeah, it's a dangerous time, isn't it? I suppose whenever there's an incident like this that forces us all to look very closely at so many different issues that that kind of knee-jerk responses to what may in the end turn out to be a small kind of terror cell, who knows, but you do worry that knee-jerk responses start to sort of change the whole cultures of societies and, you know, academic freedom and so on in a way that would be completely inappropriate and actually counterproductive.
And Joe, you also heard this week from Brunel professor and well-known author, of course, Will Self, who was speaking at SOAS. You went along and he had some interesting things to say on the issue of freedom of speech too.
Yeah, typically sort of outspoken, he said that freedom of speech should become a fetish and a sexual fetish at that, in reaction to the Hebdo incident. He was essentially saying that the kind of response to it and the fact that people decided to embrace these ideas around freedom of speech and embrace the magazine so wholeheartedly was kind of misplaced, and that he made the point of how with rights to freedom of speech comes responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his argument, and that caused some controversy.
Yeah, you'll find that article on our website, www.timeshighereducation.co.uk. Moving on to our cover feature this week. It's written by Holly Els, another one of our staff writers who's not here. We'll have to stop people having out-of-office duties on podcast day. We'll probably hand over to John again, actually. You can field this one. It's all about career progression for the next generation of scholars.
Yeah, I mean, we know this is something that comes up time and time again, how difficult it is for early career researchers coming out of, you know, having done a PhD, often with an academic career, first and foremost on their list of plans post graduation from that. And it's very, very difficult because there aren't as many academic posts available as there are people coming out with PhDs each year.
Mm-hmm.
What we've looked at in this article is some of the work that's going on in Europe, in particular across a range of different European countries, Germany, Switzerland and elsewhere, to try and tackle some of the progression problems that currently exist, where you get huge numbers of very talented young scholars falling by the wayside or having to endure long periods of very, very difficult professional lives where, you know, someone says often a permanent post only comes when you're aged about 40. So between ending your PhD and your professorship, you spend 10 years when you're completely unsure what's going on.
Yeah, jumping from institution to institution, short-term contract to short-term contract. Well, you know,
country to country.
Years, you know, country to country, yeah.
I mean, this is really, really tough. And when you marry that up with personal lives and commitment, somebody may, you know, for example, have got married and start a family. Well, how do you do that when perhaps you're two academics and you're having to jump between different countries and continents? We all know people, you know, I have friends who are in their sort of mid-30s who are going through this, and what we've heard previously is that what you end up with is, you know, a huge amount of attrition, really, with people just thinking that actually there's, you know, other ways, easier ways to make a living and spend your life. And that's a real problem, I think. So in Europe, there's a bunch of initiatives underway to try and tackle this, and for example, there's moves afoot in Germany and elsewhere to try and introduce tenure at an earlier age, so people are having much more clarity and stability about their careers and building their careers and able to see a structure that can take them from PhD and postdoc through to professor at a much earlier age.
This isn't the easy, problem, an easy ride, though, is it?
I mean, no, the problem, of course, is there are tiny number of these tenure posts being made available in these European countries. It doesn't address the broad problem that's been identified. It does for a lucky few, but the idea that you're suddenly going to have tenured posts for everybody coming out of university with a PhD that wants an academic job is never going to happen. So there's a huge amount of difficult structural difficulties, I think, to be worked through in terms of academic careers. But it's at least, I think, to be welcomed that some of these European countries are attempting to work through this. Some really interesting sort of stats and so on that have been pulled out as well. The graph I'm looking at in front of me now, actually, which shows the number of PhDs in different European countries and how they've changed over the last decade or so. And you can see that in the UK, there's been significant expansion in the number of people coming out of university with PhDs. It looks from this graph, can't tell you exactly, but it looks like maybe there were about 14,000 people completing PhDs in 2000. It now looks like it's about 22, 23,000. And although there's been some expansion within the higher education system, I think right now we're going through a period where there probably aren't a lot of new academic posts being opening up. So it's a problem that's not likely to get better anytime soon, I don't think.
No, I mean, we've spoken before about tenure with university leaders in the US. I mean, does it not, this sort of tough approach, does it not sort of separate the wheat from the chaff to a certain extent? I mean, if you can handle it in your early years, you know, you will learn, you know, you'll learn the ins and outs of a number of institutions, different departments, you'll be a better academic for it. I mean, we had Michael Crowe, didn't we, Arizona State University leader, talking to us, saying tenure had become, you know, a sort of comfort blanket, a safety net for a lot of academics. He said it wasn't a license to be a jerk, but lots of people used it in that way because they knew they had a job for life. I mean, doesn't this sort of cutting through us really sort of...
I'd be wary about talking about tenure purely in the North American terms. We're not really talking about a job for life here. It's more about career structures that offer people stability and longer-term contracts. Because actually, you know, I think you're right, and a PhD isn't clearly a guarantee of a job, nor should it be. It's a competitive industry, if I can put it like that. It's not the right word, but you know what I mean. And as are lots of other professions. We work in a competitive industry too. 100 applications for every reporter's job be advertised on THE. That's the nature of it. And as you say, it sorts the wheat from the chaff to a certain extent. But I think in academia, it is fairly unique in the way that it requires people to be so mobile internationally, to put up with short-term contracts for such a long period of time. And if you... as we explore in this feature, you end up getting to the age of 40 having gone through all this, and then you kind of fall by the wayside. It can leave people really high and dry, you know, without any other kind of industry that they can necessarily go on and work in at an appropriate level. So
I mean, I suppose it leads to a system where, you know, a lot of people will be successful because they managed to do it all, but some will only be successful because they've been willing to make a lot of sacrifices.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of that. I think that's right. And, you know, in the end, I think it is incumbent on academia to try and make it a more... It wasn't always like this. I don't think people who are finishing their academic careers now, age 60 or whatever, had such a tough time when they were starting out as early career researchers. And I think also the fact that universities to a certain extent benefit from keeping the very large pool of very talented people in this kind of state of limbo, and it can be a bit exploitative. We've previously heard from a postdoc who wrote for us a couple of years ago anonymously, but you know, I know who he is and what he's an incredibly impressive career, and he was finding it very, very hard to progress, and he said that universities were often very almost dishonest, or certainly disingenuous with early career researchers about what the prospects were, mm-hmm. and didn't encourage them to think about a plan B in terms of their career, because actually it served the university's interest to keep people, you know, going on for the next short-term contract and then, you know, thinking they might be about to make it. So I think the European moves to be a bit more, offer a bit more clarity and structure are really very welcome.
Indeed, yeah, and they're covered in some detail on page 36, or from page 36 in this week's magazine. You'll also find all the articles we've mentioned in this podcast on timeshighereducation.co.uk. You can comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything we've published, via the usual social media channels. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Google+, so do get in touch. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education issue review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.